Today and always for the rest of the session, I welcome you to the Education and Workforce Committee. I would like to acknowledge a special guest that we have visiting us today, Khosro Fatemi, who is the president of Eastern Oregon University in the back of the room. Thank you very much, sir, for coming, and we'll hear more from the president when we get to the higher ed issues. And we have two members absent today. Again, Senator Cruz is ill, and Senator Deckard's tending to a sick child. So we have normal lives as legislators. Imagine that. And so we'll look forward to them joining us at our next committee. We have several things on our agenda today as an overview, continuing with our pre-K through 12 look at the system. And first up, we have the chalkboard project, an overview, and that will be presented by Sue Hildick, president of the chalkboard project, and she's bringing a special guest. If you can just state your name for the record. And members, the chalkboard packet is your black folder. Take it away.
Thank you, Chairman Walker. We are delighted to be here. And my name is Sue Hildick. I'm president of Foundations for a Better Oregon and the Chalkboard Project. And I'm pleased to have one of our partners here, Adam Davis.
Welcome.
And what we thought we might do is give you a progress report, if you will, of where we are with the project, and then I'd like to have Adam share some of the research results we've found to date, which might be helpful to you in the session. I think, as you may know, the Chalkboard Project is a unique initiative, if you will, sponsored by Oregon's foundation community. And we have been in existence for a little over a year, and we've been active in our process for the last 10 months, which I would characterize as a public engagement process. We are doing lots of different things to learn what Oregon wants from its K-12 public schools and trying to bring to the public good, neutral information so that they can use it to make good decisions about long-term needs for our schools. It's exciting, I think, to see Foundations for a Better Oregon come into existence in this state. This is now five founding foundations who came together to form a sixth, Foundations for a Better Oregon. And just to remind you of who the players are, it's the Meyer Memorial Trust and the Collins Foundation, both based in Portland, the Geldwin Foundation in Kay Falls, the Ford Family Foundation in Roseburg, and then the Oregon Community Foundation, which of course is statewide in its focus. And so we really liked having the diversity of those five foundations, which are obviously very different, very diverse in their missions and in their philosophies. And what brought them together was a process in which we could engage Oregonians in thinking about long-term solutions for the schools. We've now been joined by five other foundations, and we have two national foundations who are looking at funding the project, one of whom wants to fund really a report, a chronicle of what we're doing, because they believe it may have merit in other states, and certainly we hope that it will. I want to just make a note that public policy is sort of a foreign land for the foundation world. This isn't a place where they have spent a lot of time. And so that's another piece I think that's really important to remember. They've all funded education projects for decades, and I think have seen a lot of innovations and great things happen. But what they haven't seen necessarily is systemic change. And what brought them together was the idea that maybe if they collaborated together around a public engagement process, they could help you help make that happen. And so those are some of our founding principles, I think, in how we came together. Chalkboard is about helping Oregon define a new vision for K-12 public education. And we frame that around three pieces. We think it's a discussion about the quality of education, the accountability of the system, and then how do we fund it. And we really think those three pieces are interwoven. Again, I just want to stress that we really come to the table as independent, neutral conveners. We do not have a position. We do not come before you with a piece of legislation. And you probably won't see that from us, again, because we literally are neutral conveners trying to raise the level of dialogue in the state. So let me give you just a snapshot of our process. I know some of you know it, but let me just refresh your memory. We are in what we call a discovery process, and we started with a great deal of public opinion research, which is why Adam's here. We've been very fortunate to have him helping us along the way. The first thing we did was survey the state of Oregon around basic questions around quality, accountability, and finance. You might consider this survey the values and beliefs survey for education in the state. It was a sample size of 1,800 Oregonians, which is probably the largest ever done in education, and has given us very credible information from eastern Oregon to the coast. We can really see the differences across the state around this issue. We have also done over 30 focus groups with teachers, principals, parents, students, superintendents, parents of special needs children, parents of Hispanic children, parents who had their children in the public school and now have them in the private school. We've really tried to look at it from every perspective and ask two questions of those groups. What are your top concerns as you see it from your vantage point? And what do you think works? What have you seen in the classrooms? What have you seen as a parent? What have you seen as a superintendent that we ought to look at as a best practice? We took all that information and fed it into the second part of our process, which was a broad review of educational practices. And we've worked with Echo Northwest and the University of Oregon to really do a survey of where are proven practices, where are promising ideas, and where are the innovations? Where are the bright ideas that maybe we don't know yet if they're going to work, but they're really inspiring people to come together around them? And those reports are now done. They were just posted on our website on Friday, and I hope many of you received copies from us. We started to distribute them last week. They're not light reading, unfortunately. Fortunately, it's about 400 pages of very good work, but I think it's a real contribution to the state in terms of really some models to think about, some things we could look at in lots of different areas in quality, accountability, and finance that might lead us to long-term improvements. Third piece of our process is sharing what we're learning. We're doing that a lot of different ways. We have launched a public awareness campaign, which you may have heard a bit about, that was designed to reach to the general public and steer them to our website where they could learn more about the current state of Oregon's education system. We have also put some simple tools up on the website, like the top 10 things you need to know about Oregon schools. We've tried to take all of this research and really boil it down into some usable tools to educate people and inform them about the basic facts. We think that's a real key piece that Chalkboard can bring to the table, is as a conveyor of information. And we've had a lot of earned media. We're doing an editorial board tour right now to encourage people to look at the website and get involved with Chalkboard and see it as a vehicle to weigh in on the future of Oregon schools. The fourth part of our process we've just kicked off, and that's really a public engagement dialogue, if you will. We started Sunday in Beaverton, and since then we've been in Albany and Astoria, and we are headed to the Dalles and Pendleton and North Clackamas and Baker City next week. We're on our tour of the state in the next 45 days. We'll be holding 20 large discussion opportunities for people to come and share their thoughts with us, and we have written a citizen feedback guide, which you have in your packet, which is organized around the top five barriers to successful schools that Oregonians told us about in our survey. And the number one barrier that they identified was the lack of parental involvement. So you'll see that our guide starts there. And really what we're presenting here are discussion starters. These are ideas out of our research or out of our focus groups that we want to start the discussion. And we have professional facilitators in these dialogues really working with people in small groups and making sure there's a lot of interaction so we can hear what people think about these important topics and bring that information back to our board. So the 20 large events will be taking place until the end of February. In addition to that, we are working at the grassroots level. We want to have dialogue in every county. So we are partnering with the Rural Development Initiative folks out of Eugene. We're subcontracting with their staff, so we have staff across the state now who are training volunteers to hold these discussions in their workplaces, in their book groups, in their homes, whatever forum they want, although we push them to try to have the conversations with people who don't have children in school. Remember, we're really trying to reach all Oregonians, in particular those 75% who don't and may not be as connected to the everyday successes that we get to hear about. What are we listening for? We're listening for common ground. We hope as we go across the state, we will start to see some areas where we can find common ground and identify those where maybe we need more work. But we're excited by the early prospects, and we're excited by the quality of the conversations we've seen so far. We're asking people to give us 2.5 to 3 hours of their time. These are intensive commitments on the part of the people who are coming, and from what we're seeing right now, the feedback is really excellent, and the ideas that are coming out, I think, will keep us busy for a long time to come, and we're anxious to share those with you. And that's really where everything wraps up. In spring, in May, we'll be able to, I think, report out what we have. We're planning to come back to you in March and give you a preview of what we found at that point, because we know your process is moving along, and by that point we will have finished our 20 large meetings. I think we'll have a pretty good sense of what we've learned from there, but please know activity is going to continue on at the grassroots level well beyond March. I think you could think of Chalkboard and its work perhaps as a catalyst to long-term change. We'd like to think of it that way, and hope as we go across the state we'll be able to build momentum around the information and the process. Now I wanted to have Adam share with you a bit of what we've learned thus far.
Thank you, Sue. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And my son's name is F, so already you've scored at least a star.
Okay. Thank you. That's a good name, by the way.
It is. It means red earth. First man.
What I'd like to do is quickly walk through a summary of the survey, and it should be in your packet. There's a website page on the front that lists all the different public opinion research projects that Chalkboard has done. This piece, everyone, you all have that?
We do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out the different focus groups that were done for Chalkboard, the qualitative research that was done, and at the very top of that list you see reference made to the poll. Down below is the work that Echo has done, and that you've got the details of in that big thick notebook that was dropped by your office last week.
I did get that. Thank you.
Very big, very thick. Sue mentioned the unique nature of this public opinion research, specifically the statewide poll that we conducted. Very seldom are we given an opportunity to interview 1,800 randomly selected Oregonians. Mm-hmm. And we work very hard in our research to make sure that that 1,800 represents a cross-section of Oregonians. The other thing that makes that project unique is that we stratified the sample, and we really looked at 6 areas of Oregon and completed 300 interviews in each of those areas. That alone is an in-depth study. So we have very good information for each of these areas of Oregon, which is very unusual. As senators, you know that a lot of the public opinion research that is done is based on proportional samples. And what happens when you do statewide research is what? The Valley gets a lot of interviews. Other areas of the state don't get as many interviews. Therefore, the information from those areas of the state is not as statistically reliable. This was taken care of by the sample design. For statewide read, for the statewide read, we were able to statistically weight those 6 areas to give us an idea of how the full state feels. So what I'm going to share with you, and I know you're on a tight schedule, is the tip of the tip of the iceberg, okay? Because you can imagine we've got several feet of data that we're still combing through for helpful information. So I'm going to refer you to the second page here, the slide that's titled What Oregonians Want. And it's very clear from our research, both our survey research and our focus group research, that Oregonians want a K-12 public education system that is among the very best or the very best in the nation. Very clear. If you take a look at the next slide at the bottom of that page, you can see the percentages. 57% say it should be among the very best in the country, and about a quarter of Oregonians say no, it should be the best. Now, that's the expectation, right? So we know what the expectations are. How do they feel about things now? You move to the next page, and we ask them to rate the state's public education system. In other words, how do you feel about Oregon schools? But it's interesting to note that they feel differently about their local schools. So if you take a look at this slide at the top here, we have a majority of Oregonians feeling that their local schools are doing a very good or somewhat good job. Do you see that? That's the 24% plus the 38%. But when you ask them about the state, how Oregon's K through 12 schools are doing, the system, the K through 12 public education system, we're below 50%. We're at about 45% saying somewhat good or very good, and that just doesn't match up with their expectations.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator.
Adam, just a question on that. So is that universal across the regions where folks would rate their local schools, whether that's in Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, the Portland area, or the Dalles, they would all rate their schools very high locally?
Senator Decker, you're absolutely right. That's a consistent pattern that we saw across the state, that people feel better about their local schools than they do about schools across the state of Oregon.
Consistent.
And it is consistent. And the other thing that's interesting is that you will notice variations among regions for how they feel about their local schools, which is the next slide. You'll see that people in eastern and central Oregon feel better about their schools, rate them higher in terms of feeling either somewhat good or very good about them than other areas. But you know, overall, if you go down to Willamette Valley and Coast, there, you see that 62% down below? See, that 62% matches up with the 62% in the slide above. So it just gives you an idea of the regions. But we learned when we went into Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, and Southern Oregon, there's a connection, there's a qualitative difference in the connection between the people in those communities and their school. What happens is that the schools seem to have a stronger connection with non-parents in these outlying areas than they do in more urban areas of the state. And we could speculate as to the reason for that, but you guys have been out there. You probably sense it yourself. We've been able to talk to people about it. If we have time, we could talk more about that. But, Senator, you're absolutely right. Feel better about local than state, and local varies across the state. The next slide is, in addition to educating students, why do we need strong schools? This is a real interesting question, because what it shows is that if you want to engage Oregonians in a discussion about the future of K through 12 education, you may have to walk them through different doors. For some people, it is just not about educating students. For some people, it's about other things. And we wanted to get a sense as to what those other things are and how important they are to people. And right at the top of the list was reducing crime and social problems, followed by teaching kids the basics of citizenship and civics, keeping families in the community, benefiting the economy in the long run, being a community center for the town or neighborhood, and improving residential property values. Senator, this varies by area as well. There'll be some areas in Oregon where, for example, improving residential property values would be much higher than the statewide results show. But I think this is an important piece to keep in mind. We had a focus group participant. Remember this one? I'll never forget this quote because it just almost knocked me off the moderator chair. And the person said, until this state learns to think of students being the accidental beneficiaries of a good K through 12 education system, then we're not on the right track. And I probed and I pressed him, and it was fascinating to hear his explanation. He said, people have to understand that a good K through 12 education system is more than about just educating students. It's about quality of life in our communities, and that just involves a lot of other dimensions than just educating students. And I press, well, what do you mean? Well, the importance to economic development, the importance of keeping people out of prison and needing social services. So I thought that was a real interesting way of putting it, the accidental beneficiaries of a good education system.
Mr. Davis, Senator Morsett.
Yes, thank you. Teaching kids the basics of citizenship and civics. Now, I've had a bill every single session, an effort to include that. It is not being included. I taught for 28 years at Springfield High School. I did teach that. The guide from the district says 6 weeks. Local government teachers do not do that because there is not a curriculum guide. There's not teacher training. And it's very frustrating. And it's interesting that people rate this so highly. Now, maybe at third grade they talk about the fire engine and the police car and all of the things that are very basic, but I'm very frustrated. Now, there's another effort. There's a group of people out there who are trying to push this forward again, but we need your help, I guess. And if this is true, that's one of the higher priorities, then we need to work even harder. But they view that as an unfunded mandate. We're going to have teacher training. We've got to get textbooks. We have to do all these things, and we just can't afford to do it, is the reason used. But I applaud you for your work, and I'm very happy to see the ranking of that particular item.
And we triangulated a lot of these questions. We asked them more than once. We wanted to really validate the findings. And, Senator, I could tell you that there were other areas in the survey where this particular area is felt to be very important by Oregonians. Another communication issue is how do you talk about the value of education? Is it only in terms of getting students ready for college, which I think there may be a default? You see a lot of folks go in that direction right away. I think our advice would be it's more also than just preparing students to be ready for college. We force choice Oregonians. Pick one of these three: students ready for work and graduate students who have sufficient social skills. And you can see that we did not have a majority for any one of them. They're all important to different segments of Oregon residents. Some people feel that the most important thing to do is graduate students who are ready for work. Others feel that it's all about college. And we have almost a fifth saying that the most important thing is that they know how to work independently, they know how to work together, it's those social skills. We follow up a lot of these quantitative questions with focus group research to kind of put the meat on the bones and learn more about what it is that they're saying in these responses. The next slide gets to this whole issue of basics, Senator, and right at the very top of the list is just, listen, we've got to make sure Oregon students know how to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. We've got to be sure that they know how to read, write, and speak. And we gave them a tough scale, an unusual scale. We went one a point on that scale above very important to include required. So it was required, very important, somewhat important, and not important. And all by itself in a tier was the basics, these two at 63% and 69%. And you know Oregonians. There is always a percentage of Oregonians that will put thumbs down to anything that you say should be required. But to get those kinds of percentages required for something like that, I think tells you where they want to see the emphasis. The regional differences, just a particular issue that we looked closely at was closing the achievement gap, which is an issue that you know that, for example, the Portland Public Schools is dealing with and other urban districts. And isn't it interesting to see that the perception is that this is a more urgent priority in those areas of Oregon than in other areas of Oregon. So a little validation, not to be unexpected. And finally, very quickly, this gets to what Sue was saying about the obstacles to success right at the top of the list. I mean, I think we all expected funding to be up there, but isn't it interesting that Oregonians see it to be more than just money, that there are other things out there that need to be addressed, that need to be looked at very closely than just money. And there's they're telling us that there's something that has to be done about parental involvement, attracting and retaining highly qualified teachers. The finding on mandates was a bit of a surprise to Chalkboard, and that was that there is awareness and knowledge around the issue of unfunded mandates. And I think if you look back, and there's been a lot of discussion about this. I mean, it was part of the election last year, but even before that, it was something that was really being kicked around in the media. It's registered as an issue for the average Oregonian. It's just not opinion leaders and the usual suspects, but out there in the ranks, this is an issue that people are aware of and have feelings about. And finally, central administration waste and inefficiency, and you should know that that's very much on the minds of people, not unexpectedly so.
As it is with us. Now, Senator Stern has a question.
The issue there of not attracting or retaining highly qualified teachers, have you in your focus groups explored that in depth and what I perceive to be inadequate preparation of teachers coming out of our teacher training colleges?
Well, just a couple of comments, and Sue might want to chime in here, too. I think it's important to understand that Oregonians have an incredible amount of respect for teachers. Teachers are at the top of the list when we ask people about different professions, how they feel about different groups in this whole education arena. Now, I want to distinguish, and you're paying Chalkboard is us to be impartial and independent. They don't feel necessarily the same way about teacher unions. So distinguish that. But teachers right at the top of the list. But I'll tell you, when you talk to members of the general public, when you talk to parents in a focus group setting, it's one of those things where the story of the bad teacher always comes up. And everyone has memories of great teachers that made a big impact on their lives, but they also have memories of teachers that did that it could have been better, could have done a better job. And so what we heard a lot about was how you go about hiring teachers, how do you go about promoting teachers, how do you go about training teachers, and a real desire on the part of Oregonians to look at those things and look at ways to improve how we go about doing those kinds of things.
Thank you. Senator Deckard.
How did the politicians rank in that?
I think you know, Senator.
We know, that's one aspect.
That's right.
I do have one. On the above slide on that page, were those open-ended questions, or were those prompted responses?
That's a very good question. Those were in a list of different things that we heard from focus groups and that we've seen in other research to be obstacles. So it was close-ended, Senator.
And they just went down the list.
Right. They told us which ones were most important. So they rated every one either a very big obstacle or a big obstacle, and these were the ones that, when you combine those two percentages, were rated to be the biggest obstacles. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise is the bottom slide, right? Makes your job real easy. You have a state that's basically split on this issue of funding. Schools are not spending the money efficiently. 4 out of 10 Oregonians felt this when we did the survey. We had 52% feeling that they don't have enough money. They need more money to do the job right. You have 8% of Oregonians who don't know. And then remember that for both the 40% and the 58%, there's, of course, a spectrum in terms of strength of conviction that you've got to keep in mind, too. You know our firm, I think some of you, and we've been doing research in the state for years, and we can tell you with a great deal of confidence that this state is really split on this issue of funding. Your job is not an easy one. But I can also tell you that returning to that slide above, that people see it to be more than about funding. They really do. And people who come into a focus group feeling that it's just about one thing, by the time they talk with fellow citizens and they start thinking about these issues, quickly realize that it's not that easy and that there are a lot of things that need to be looked at and considered. And that's what Chalkboard's all about, looking at not only finance, but quality and accountability as well. Final two slides, 66% said that Oregon's K through 12 public education system needs to do more about quality, accountability, and finance. 61% agree that Oregon needs a group of independent, nonpartisan organizations to convene to improve the state's K through 12 education system. There's a lot of fatigue around this issue out there. There really is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of skepticism, cynicism, negativism, around this issue, around government and politics in general. I think the cloud just kind of just carries over right over education. But despite all that, despite being on the telephone with them, in some cases for as long as 40 minutes, one out of every three respondents that we interviewed agreed to give us personal information, their name, their address, their telephone number, and their email address to stay in touch with Chalkboard. And that's amazing, because we've done this a couple of times where we've been asked by a client to say, but ring it, see if you can get them to agree to become part of something. And this was amazing. I think the best I've ever seen is 1 out of 10, and 1 out of 3 at the end of a long interview like that was just, I think, very heartening to Chalkboard.
Well, and I really appreciate these comments and what you've done, and it sort of brings to mind that, you know, most Oregonians really like their own legislator, but they have different views about the legislature.
Absolutely. It's a very good parallel to what we see with schools.
Yeah, and so it's good to see that Oregonians still care about their education system. They just think it's broken and needs fixed, and you know, you've offered some ideas about what they think is wrong. It's one of the things that I've been thinking about is if you want more money for education, you have to show Oregonians that you're spending it right. Mm-hmm. You have to show them that the administration is not top-heavy, that the money's getting to the classroom, to the children, where it should be. And they do revere their teachers because they're a wonderful link to the system. They're the people that you remember forever and ever in your life. I mean, I remember my second grade teacher. I remember my first grade teacher hitting me on the hand with a ruler because I used a skinny pencil instead of a fat pencil. But then I remember the wonderful teachers too, and you know, they stick with you your whole life, and I just so am appreciative that Oregonians care about that, and your project is just tremendous. I really enjoy what you're doing. I have a couple questions, and the committee has some.
Yeah.
How do you work with Quality Education Commission? Are you working with them at all?
We are. We've been working with them from the beginning to share information,
okay.
And the QEM was a large part of the research we looked at.
Okay.
We didn't want to recreate that, so what we did was involve it in our review of best practices, so you'll find it in our research reports.
And so they have an amount of 7.1 billion as being their ideal amount to fund education. Are you starting from that premise? Are you mm-hmm. even going to
no.
that premise? You're just
no, we're not. We're not starting from it. We're not going there in the short term. We're trying to focus on quality and accountability first before we get to the finance question, because we think we have to know what we all want from the system before we start talking about how we fund it, how we stabilize it, those kinds of questions.
And I think you're right on the same track that I am. Quality and accountability first, and then you talk about the long-term goal, and that's it. If the QEC, the Quality Education Commission, says we need $7.1 billion, then how do we get there? What's the long-term plan? And I think that's what you're trying to help
yeah,
us with.
I think we are. I would just make one comment, maybe Adam can elaborate on it. We asked people in our focus groups about the quality education model, and I think we had over 100 people in all 30 groups, and I think we had 2 people who knew what that was. And if we're going to use it, and I'm not suggesting one way or the other, we have to involve the public in what that means, because right now it doesn't appear like they have any knowledge of what that is.
Yeah, that's an insider's policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be careful there, too, because we had groups of teachers, and we worked real hard to reach beyond just the activists, the ones that are real active in the profession, and their awareness and knowledge levels were very low as well, not to mention pretty skeptical and cynical about the whole process.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, you had a question.
Yes. Did you talk about kindergarten specifically, or did that come up in any way, the value of... Now, we do have a... I think every district has to provide for kindergarten, but we don't make it a requirement, so there are many people who do not send their kids to kindergarten, which sometimes creates bad habits for later on and so on. A half-day kindergarten, did that topic come up?
Yes, it did, and it is indeed a project about K through 12.
Yeah.
And a related issue is, what about pre-K? And I'll address that in a second. But as far as kindergarten is concerned, people get the connection. What you invest in those early years is critical in terms of what happens later on. And it was very heartening for us to see the connection between, for example, how important reading is at those early grade levels to the development of an individual. And I think you'll see in the chalkboard work a lot of reference made to early reading programs and what goes on in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. The public gets it, Senator. They would love to support pre-K. It's more an issue of priorities right now, and as much as they get it, you'll see in our survey, and I believe in others, that if it's pre-K versus K through 12, right now there's if you present it as a trade-off between the two, you're going to see K through 12 being ranked as more important than pre-K. If money was no object, or in the best of all worlds, you would see incredible support for pre-K. If you ask about pre-K in isolation, that's the trouble with public opinion research. You got to always be careful about what context you're asking the question. But if you ask about pre-K in isolation, how important it is, do you support programs, you have a majority of Oregonians saying it's very important and they support it.
I'm not talking about pre-K.
Okay. You're talking about K.
I'm talking about the half-day kindergarten that every district has, and I would like to see it mandatory for parents to take advantage of that half-day kindergarten. I don't know what kind of a fiscal impact that would be on the districts, but that's what I'm talking about, is taking advantage of the kindergarten, which does prepare people for reading, and those who go through that are usually better, they're ahead. Mm-hmm. And you know, as Senator Starr says a lot, you know, I mean, he refers to reading readiness that, you know, people lack sometimes. One other quick idea. If you do another survey on politicians, put the word statesman in and see if figure out how do you get to that statesman's part if you don't go through the first part that nobody likes? They all love the
Senator,
second part.
Don't forget stateswoman.
Stateswoman.
You can do statesperson.
Statesperson.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We have to move on with our agenda, and I really appreciate and look forward to bringing you back
in
March.
Thank you.
And the next folks on our agenda, we have Richard Bielan, the state housing analyst, who's going to talk about Oregon's demographics, past, present, and future. And I think Bob Repine is coming up with him.
What is Bob Repine doing in an education year? It's all sitting over there.
He's a little nervous, doesn't he?
Yes, it does.
Well, you know, it's amazing how many fingers he has out there, and maybe he's building schools now.
And I do want to welcome Senator Deckert to the committee. Your child must be improving in her health this afternoon.
Yes.
So that's good to hear. Thank you.
Madam
Chair. Yes, state your name, please. Welcome.
My name is Bob Adam Reedman.
Stole my life.
I thought I'd make some quick points early.
Yeah.
I actually have kind of crowded into Mr. Bielan's presentation for a couple of reasons. This is the only second week of the session, and I just didn't want to send him over here so quick, so soon by himself. And second of all, I actually wanted to kind of give you the framework of how this report came about. So you're right, Senator Decker. Education is not necessarily one of our main driving issues in our agency. However, it plays very strongly in the end products that we work with people with housing. This study that Richard did
He probably will tell you a little bit about his credentials or his academic to be able to present this to you. Richard is a very unique individual who's we're very fortunate to have in the housing agency, who has a tremendous amount of knowledge about housing and those issues that affect housing. He's been currently working with a housing inventory strategy so we can delineate housing needs in communities based on populations and incomes. And so a variety of new tools that we're able to use to help the building community understand what is needed in their community versus what they think they should build, and find out that it's not really the right targeted population. This study was actually started by Richard by a request of myself to, as we were looking at single-family home ownership. In Oregon today, single-family home ownership by Oregonians is about 64%, of which minorities, particularly Hispanics and Latinos, have about a 33% home ownership factor. So what we were trying to do, and that also plays into other minorities, so what we've been trying to do in our agency is try to, how do we have an influence on getting more minorities able and ready to become homeowners? And so it was under that pretense we started this discussion on doing an analysis of the demographics around Hispanics and Latinos for the state of Oregon. As I will tell you, and you'll find out, the report has a little bit of everything, has something in for everybody. There isn't probably one committee or one group or one agency that really couldn't benefit from this report. We found out, you know, what some of the natural barriers or the things are that are keeping people in this minority group from being homeowners. But at the same time, you learn a lot about the economic dollars that they generate or don't generate. They get an idea of their capacity for what role they will play in the future support of Oregon and Oregonians as we become older. So it really starts evolving into a very very broad informational base. Much of it, as Richard has presented to the Department of Education, is around Hispanic and Latino growth in populations, around readiness or preparedness for the aspects of teaching a growing population, and how are we going to be prepared. It goes to the same thing for banking industries, to know whether or not they have the right staff on board who can speak Spanish as a second language. It goes to service providers, including private and public service providers, do they have the right staff to be able to interface with the population that's going to be a significant part of the face of Oregon in the next 20 years. So it was under that pretense we started this study. But again, I would tell you that there's a little bit of something for everybody in this. And so I'm very appreciative that you're taking the time to hear this. And I think you'll find that even though we started out looking at housing, it has an amazing, it will have an amazing effect on you as individuals. And the charge that you will be faced with in the years to come in this session on how you're going to deal with the multitude of issues you have to deal with. So I'm not going to answer any questions. I'm leaving. I'm going back to office. But I just wanted to give Richard at least a little pat on the back or some recognition for the hard work that he's been doing for this agency.
Well, thank you, Mr. Repine. It was Senator Brown who clued us into this research, and so we immediately decided this would be a good thing for the rest of the committee, and we're glad to have you.
I think you'll find it very enjoyable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Chair Walker, members of the Commission, I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to share some of the research that I have done on the changing demographics in Oregon.
And can you state your name for the record, please?
Richard Bieland. I'm a state housing analyst, Oregon Housing and Community Services Department.
Thank you, sir.
I think that the information that I provide here is especially relevant to the Committee on Education and Workforce, because the environment and the population that will be served both in education and in the workforce are the population, are the people of Oregon. And so you have to have an understanding of whether the demographics of the Oregon population is changing or not. And I think it will be very clear that it is changing at a much more rapid pace than anyone has, I think, appreciated in the past, and that we better prepare ourselves for these changes. When we're talking about demographic changes, one of the first things we want to do is talk about changes in racial and ethnic composition. And I think you have to have some definitions when you're doing this type of presentation, and that therefore a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity may be of any race. And a minority is a person that represents an individual of any race other than white only, a multiracial individual, or a person of Hispanic or Latino ethnicity. And so for purposes of the presentation, a non-minority is a white-only, which is a white-only non-Hispanic or Latino person. Now, thinking about Oregon, we don't operate in a vacuum. And so it's, I think, very illustrative to look at what's happening in the United States and then drive it, build it down to the local level. And you can see that in 1980, Hispanics represented 6.4% of the population. In 1990, 9%, and in 2000, 12.5%. And people say, well, that's still a small percentage of the population. But if you look what happens in the dynamics of changes in demographics, it's not just the percentage, it's the percent changes that are taking place, mm-hmm. and the percent of the change that different minority groups or cohort groups represent. And you can see that in 1990, while they represented 9% of the population, they represented almost 40% of the population growth in the United States. Whereas the white population was 3 and 4, but only represented 20% of the population growth in the last decade in the United States. I'm going to have to skip through some of these slides very quickly, but what I have here in the handout is all of the slides plus some additional slides that I have in the full presentation. And on the cover sheet, I have a link to the full amount of the demographic presentation that's on our website, so people can look at that.
Thank you.
But you look about household growth over the next 20 years, the non-Hispanic white household growth, who represent 69% of the population, are going to represent only about a third of the household growth over the next 20 years. Minorities, who represent 31% of the population, are almost going to represent two-thirds of the population growth, and Hispanics, 12.5%, 31.5% of the household growth. And this is misleading, because when you look at, that's households, you look at population, and it's even more dramatic. Now, if we look at the source, projected source of the U.S. population growth over the next 50 years, you can see that the white population is only going to represent 10% of the population growth in the United States over the next 50 years. Minorities are going to represent 90% of the U.S. population growth. Hispanics are going to represent almost half of that population growth. And in fact, in the last decade of the first half of the century, the white population will actually be decreasing in the United States. So that's what's taking place in the United States. Now, if we look at from a regional standpoint, it looks at what's happening in the West. In 1980, minorities represented 26.5% of the population of the West. 1990, 33.4%. In the year 2000, 41.6%. By 2010, 50% of the West's population will be minorities. 50% of the West population. In fact, in the 90s, 12 states lost white population mm-hmm. in the United States. If you look at the Hispanic population, you can see that that also has grown dramatically from 14.5% in 1980 to 24% in the year 2000. In 2010, Hispanics will represent 1 in 3 persons in the Western United States. Oregon, of course, is a part of the Western United States. So I said, well, let's look at California. Much of what happens in Oregon is influenced by California. And in fact, in the 90s, 80% of California's population growth was Hispanic. California actually lost white population during the 90s. We look at the total numbers. In 1990, the increase in California's Hispanic population was just under 3.3 million persons. That's equivalent to the entire population of the state of Oregon. In just 10 years, that was California's growth in the Hispanic population. Now, let's look at Oregon's minority population. In 1980, we only had 6.7% of our population as minority. In 1990, it was 9.2%. And in 2000, it was 16.5%. But again, that 9.2% in 1990 is very misleading, because of Oregon's population growth during the 90s, 52% of Oregon's population growth was minorities. We look at Oregon's population by ethnicity. We can see that Hispanics represented only 2.5% in 1980, 4% in 1990, and 8% in the year 2000. Again, people say 8% of your population. That's a very small number. But look at what's happened in Salem. It went from 3.5% to 6.1% to 14.6%. Marion County, from 4.7% to 17% of Marion County's population It was as Hispanic in 2000. Now, I happen to live in Woodburn. Woodburn's, I think, a forerunner of what's going to happen in many other parts of Oregon. In 1980, Hispanics were 18% of the population, 31% in 1990, and just over 50% in the year 2000. In a 20-year time frame, it went from 18% of the population to just over 50%. Now, we talk about education, and I said it would be interesting to take a look at the impact on the educational system of these changes. And so I asked the Woodburn School District to provide me with information. In 1990, when Hispanics were 31% of Woodburn's population, they represented 44% of the student population in the school district. In the year 2000, when they were 50% of the population, they were now 64% of the student population in the Woodburn School District. 4 years later, they are now 72% of the student population in the Woodburn School District. Talk about teacher preparedness, talking about having the qualifications. I was asked to present to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission about a month and a half ago, and they said, boy, we've got to be rethinking a lot of our things, and they're going to invite me back to help them in some of these areas. Now, I just talk about the gross numbers. In 1990, Hispanics were only 1,251 students. 14 years later, they had almost tripled to 3,405 students in the Woodburn School District. So the dramatic changes that are taking place, I think, is very definite. Now, I said, let's look at what's happened in California, in the California demographics. In 1970, 4 in 5 Californians were white. Today, whites are in the minority in California. In a 30-year time frame, you've gone from 80% to less than 50% in the largest state in the United States. So these changes can take place at a very rapid rate, more so than most people are understanding and appreciating. Today, only 1 in 3 children in California's public school system is white. 45% are Latino throughout the California school system. In Los Angeles, only 10% of the students in the Los Angeles school district are white. 90% are minorities, 70% are Latino. And in fact, in District F in the Los Angeles Unified School District has 60,000 students. 98% are minorities, contains Belmont High School, of which has 5,500 students, and it only has a 40% graduation rate. If we look at Multnomah County by ethnicity, it's went from 2% in 80 to 3.1% in 90 to 7.5% in the year 2000. Again, fairly small numbers, but if you look at Gresham, another major city, it went from 1.8% to 3.3% to 12% in the year 2000. Very dramatic growths. And you look at the increase in the population, the white-only population in Multnomah County only increased by 2%. In Gresham, it only increased by 13%, whereas the minority population in Multnomah County increased by 80%, Hispanic by 170%, and in Gresham, 250% and 370%. So these are very dramatic changes that are taking place in much of what's happening in Oregon. And again, this just sort of reemphasizes that. Now, we look at the growth rate of Oregon's population. During the 80s, the non-Hispanic or Latino population, which includes white and all other minorities other than Hispanic, only grew by 6.3%, while the Hispanic population grew by 71%. In the 90s, we had better times, and the non-Hispanic population grew by 15%, but the Hispanic population grew by 144%. Again, Marion County, same type of changes. Now, if you look at population growth, it basically comes from two different components. The net migration, which is your in-migration less your out-migration, and your natural increase, which is your births less your deaths. And so I said it would be interesting to take a look at that. We can see that in the 80s when Oregon was having some tough economic times, we had very little in-migration. The natural increases remained fairly constant. But you can see in the 90s, we had significant amounts of in-migration. And I think we will continue to see that, especially with the dramatic growth in populations in California. And now, if we look at the percent foreign-born of a population, and again, you can look at that since we're short on time here, I'll skip on through this. Look at how immigrants disperse to the new growth states. Basically, they come into six states, California, Texas, Florida, Illinois, New York, and New Jersey, and then they disperse from there. And, of course, Oregon is right next to California. And look at the percent foreign-born by region, and you can see that of Oregon's foreign-born, 45% came from Latin America, 27% from Asia, only about 19% from Europe. Look at the legal status of foreign-born population. Less than 1 in 3 is a legal alien. Less than 1 in 3 is a naturalized citizen. About 1 in 4 is an undocumented alien, and the rest comprise temporary residents and refugee arrivals. Look at the citizen status of the foreign-born population in Oregon. 33.6% of the foreign-born are naturalized citizens compared to 40% around the U.S. But, of course, it's very much a function of how long they've been there. As you can see, the most recent immigrants to the U.S. are the least likely to become, of course, naturalized citizens. Now, what does that mean from an educational and a workforce standpoint? If you look at the percent of the population that is limited in English proficient, you can see of the native-born population, only about 1% are limited English proficient. But if you look at all foreign-born, only 44% of them are limited English proficient. And in fact, if you look at the more recent arrivals, 60% of them have limited English proficiency. So from an educational standpoint and from a workforce standpoint, these are key factors that have to be taken into account. Now, if we look at the natural increase, well, people say, well, maybe migration patterns will stop. Maybe we can close the border or whatever. Is that going to change things? And so I said it'd be interesting to look at the natural increase that took place in Oregon in 2001. And so, whereas in 1981, Hispanics only represent 2.7% of all births, in 2001, they were 17.4% of births when they represented 8% of the population. But when you factor in deaths into the equation to get natural increase, you can see that even though Hispanics were 8% of Oregon's population in the year 2000, they represented 49% of the natural increase in population simply because of the difference between births and deaths between these two categories. So even if there was absolutely no additional net migration patterns into Oregon, the fact that there are these characteristics, and I'll show you why that's taking place, still will account for significant demographic changes, irrespective of the fact that it's a very small percentage of our population. Of course, birth rates, they're about double the birth rate of the white population. Now we look at Oregon counties. There are actually 9 Oregon counties that lost population from 2000 to 2003. There were an additional 10 counties that were at risk of losing population, either because of a negative natural increase, they had more deaths than births, or because of people leaving those counties. And so those have dramatic changes from an educational standpoint and from a workforce standpoint. We have 19 counties that are either losing population or are at risk of losing population. If we look at the characteristics of the population, one of the things is, of course, the persons per household. And you can see that the average household size for a non-Hispanic household is about 2.5 persons, where the average household size for a Hispanic household is about 4.3 persons. And so even though they were 8% of the population in Oregon, they only represent less than 5% of the households. So if you're talking about delivery to households and a population begins to take on more of the characteristics of the resident population and the number of persons per household changes, this can have a dramatic change even without any increase in population in the number of households that are being formed. And from a housing delivery standpoint, of course, that's very important to us. If we look at the source of Oregon's population and growth, again, in the 80, Hispanics were only 2.5% of the population. They represent 22% of the population growth. 94%, they represent 28% of the population growth. But let's look at what's happened in the last 3 years. The white population in the blue here, from Oregon's population growth from 2000 to 2003, 42% of Oregon's population growth was white. From 2002 to 2003, that had dropped 37%. And in fact, and the far right there is the Hispanic percent of the population growth in Oregon. Hispanic population in Oregon increased more rapidly than the white population in the last year. And you can imagine that this change is going to accelerate dramatically. Again, these are just sources. I mean, 54% of Marion County's population growth in the 90s was Hispanic. But in the last 3 years, 81% of Marion County's population growth has been Hispanic. 81% of Marion County's population growth has been Hispanic in the last 3 years. So, I mean, these are the people that are going to be coming into the school system and into the workforce. Okay. What's taking place from a distribution of the population from an age standpoint? And I think we're all aware that we're getting older and the younger part of the population is decreasing. We're also, this shows we're getting older. But what's interesting is looking at the age and sex distribution of the population, because this is what's driving these demographic changes. You look at 1900, we had this classic pyramid where the youngest age group was the largest age category in a five-year segment, and each succeeding five-year segment had a smaller segment of the population. By the year 2000, it was taking on more of a barrel shape. But that's the total population. If you begin to disaggregate that, you can see that if you look at the white population, it's becoming even more dramatic. And in fact, if you look at the childbearing years for the white population is one of the smallest age segments. And in fact, the under five population, which is population coming into the school system, the population that's going to be going eventually into the childbearing years and creating additional, is smaller than the 60 and over population in the white population. Yet you look at the Hispanic population from the same standpoint, and you can see that the childbearing years is the largest segment other than the under five, which of course is again what's coming into the school system, and the people in childbearing years are going to be producing more students. From a workforce standpoint, if we look at the foreign-born population comparing it with the native-born population, we can see that of the foreign-born population, 59% of them are in the prime working age years, where only 42% of the native-born population is in the prime working age. So what does that mean? If we look at the share of Hispanic population, and 40% of the Hispanic population was first generation, and for the next 20 years, that's going to decrease somewhat, but not to a significant extent. And these are people who were born outside of the United States. If we look at the educational attainment by Hispanics, we can see of the first generation, 54% have less than a high school education. And in fact, in second and third generations, it's still around 1 in 4 have less than a high school education. Now, what's some of the significance of this? If we look at the growth of the U.S. labor force over the next 20 years, 52% of the projected growth of the U.S. labor force over the next 20 years is going to be Hispanics. 52%. And the U.S. workforce is the economic engine that's driving the U.S. economy. If we look at the full-time worker earnings by race, ethnicity, and educational attainment, we can see that Hispanics basically are between the less than a high school and a high school earnings potential for all the Hispanic population. The interesting look at the per capita income as a percent of the white-only per capita income. And so I set the white-only per capita income at 100. We look at the Hispanic, it's 45 cents on a dollar for the per capita income. Now, I said, let's look at the ratio of working age persons to age persons age 65 and over. In 1940, there were 8.6 working age persons for everyone age 65 and over. In the year 2000, that had decreased to 4.7. By the year 2030, it's going to be 2.8 working age persons for everyone age 65 and over. Who is going to be comprising that 2030 working force population? So I said it'd be interesting to do a tax revenue analysis. So what I did is in Oregon, I took the median white household with median household size. I did a calculated a federal tax return and an Oregon tax return. I took the median Hispanic household and its median income and its median household size, and I calculated the same situation. The median income for a white household was just under $42,000 compared to just under $32,000 for a Hispanic household. But when I did the tax-like calculation, whereas the median white household paid $3,804 in federal taxes, the median Hispanic household actually got a $90 tax rebate. When I did it from an Oregon's revenue standpoint, the white median household paid $2,452 in Oregon taxes. The Hispanic median household paid $836 for a 66% reduction in Oregon tax revenues. The federal government is seeing a 100% reduction in federal tax revenues. If we are maintaining the situation of the median incomes for a Hispanic household and we're replacing a white household with a Hispanic household, this is going to have tremendous revenue impacts from a tax standpoint and from a governmental standpoint. Looking at household types, back in 1960, what was thought to be the traditional American family, a married couple with children under 18, represented in the top part of the graph 43% of the population of the households in Oregon. In the year 2000, that was down to 22.2%, smaller than the single-person households and smaller than the families with no children households. The only household size that hasn't been changing has been, of course, the families with no children under 18. But the single parent with children under 18 and the multi-person non-family households have also seen very rapid growth. So when you think about who you are delivering services to, the characteristics of those households are very important to take into account. And in fact, if I said, well, of Oregon's household growth, where has it occurred over the last four decades? In fact, in the last three decades, in fact, in the decade of the 80s, Oregon actually lost those married couple with children under 18 households. We had less of them in 1990 than we did in 1980. Yet in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, those were by far the smallest household formation growth in Oregon. They were single-person households, and families with no children under 18 were much larger numbers of household formations. So what are some of the conclusions that you can draw from this? That we're rapidly changing from what's been primarily a nation of white non-Hispanic persons to a racially and ethnically diverse population. That the Hispanic, Latino, and Asian populations are the fastest growing cohorts, white only the slowest. That the Hispanic, Latino population increases now account for the greatest percent of the U.S. growth and now for the greatest percent of Oregon's growth. And therefore, planning and policy decisions in education, housing, social services should reflect these patterns of growth.
Thank you, Mr. Bion. Senator Morissette.
The question of citizenship always intrigued me because every baby born in the United States is a citizen, and so you have the Hispanic population that migrates, and I often wondered about the balance of the non-citizen Hispanic and the citizen Hispanic. Now, you may have a mother and father who aren't not citizens, but all the children might be, and that raises some interesting questions.
And that one slide showed the first, second, and third generation, and the first generation is not born here. The second generation is they were born here, but at least one of their parents were foreign-born.
Yeah.
And then the third generation is both individual and parents were born in the United States.
Well, I guess the intriguing thing is there's always a question of whether or not people are eligible for services. Now, obviously, citizens are who are born here are, and then the question is, you know, parents. And I know that we have, the Oregon Health Plan, various things that you're supposed to be a citizen. call whether or not they get in-house or in-state grades for college. We, you know, those are all really blurred kinds of things, and I don't know how you track that, or I don't know if it's
important. Well, I think it
track.
Maybe highlights the importance, and I know that the Woodburn, in fact, student bodies, yeah, even had a FAST there because they wanted to promote, which had been a previous bill in the last legislature, to allow non-citizen, I guess, to, or people who have been born in Oregon but maybe weren't citizens, to be eligible for in-state tuition as opposed to out-of-state tuition. And,
that's true with the community college right now. It's not true with the universities, though.
All right.
But it's an interesting question because they are a lot, well, if you're born here, you're a citizen, eligible, you know, for all of the rights.
All right.
Thank you. That was a good presentation. Excellent.
Senator Starr, did you have a question? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vialan. One question I had is, I noticed that that seemed that the increase was mostly with the Hispanic population. Is our African American population and Asian population moving at a much slower rate?
African American population has been very stable and has not grown significantly. Asian population is a very rapidly growing population. It actually grew more rapidly during the 80s and 90s, maybe a little bit less so in the more recently, but they've had a high growth rate, just that they've been a very small percentage throughout, other than in California, where they were still a significant portion of California's growth. I think they were 24% of California's population growth in the 90s, because white population actually lost, and Hispanics were 80% of the population growth.
Do you think that a good percentage of the in-migration is coming from California?
I would say yes. I mean, I have, I didn't include it here, but in my full presentation I have slides on the in-migration, out-migration, both from California and from Oregon, showing, and basically California is exporting Hispanic population, so they're a net exporter. Oregon, of course, is importing, having less people of Hispanic leaving Oregon, but more people coming in.
Looking for that
rapid growth that California has experienced, you're going to see perhaps an acceleration of that trend.
Yeah, they're looking for that quality of life here, which
right.
we have.
Right.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I wish we had more time for you today, but I really appreciate you coming. I think your information has been very valuable, and it's so strange that it started out in the housing division, and it just so much applies to so many different agencies. So, thank you.
Well, it's been a popular presentation. I've had to give to many different bodies recently, so I appreciate the opportunity today. Thank you.
Thank you. You want to hit the lights, Madam Administrator? All right. Our next panel will bring you up first in groups of two, and we're going to talk about cultural competency in schools and closing the achievement gap. And I'd like to hear first from Pat Burke from the Department of Education and Charlie Benitez from also from the department. And then after their presentation, it'll last about a half an hour, we'll hear from Yvette Weber-Davis from the Oregon University System and Joyce Harris from the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory. State your name and we'll get started.
Thanks, Gail. You
can hand this to the committee administrator, Mr. Burke, and I'll take care of it. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Pat Burke. I am the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education, and it's really delightful to follow Richard. I've heard his presentation several times. He has presented to the State Board of Education as well as to the follow the Education Commission, and I actually keep a copy of his data on my laptop, which is either a compliment to Richard or may tell you a little bit about my life. I think his data are very compelling and really set a framework for what we want to talk with you about today. We're going to be talking about closing the achievement gap and cultural competence, and these two issues are very closely related. Our time is short, and you have a number of people to hear this afternoon, so let me move forward. First, what is the achievement gap, which is, I believe, a basic question. Now, both federal and state regulations establish expectations that every student in Oregon should achieve state standards. So how are we doing in meeting that objective? Now, there are detailed charts on this issue in the Oregon State Report Card, which you have all received a copy of. I would, however, like to draw your attention in your handout to a one-page double-sided chart. The chart looks like this. And at the top of the first chart...
Where is that? Colleague, thank you. I have it.
At the top, you see third grade reading. Now, what you'll notice, this is data from 1996 to the present time, and you will notice two things about these data. One, that overall, from 1996 to 2004, the general trend in academic achievement and third grade reading is positive or in an upward direction. The second thing is you'll notice that the gap or the difference by ethnicity at 1996 is more pronounced, larger, than it is in 2004. So there's good news and bad news in this chart. One is that academic achievement in reading is increasing, and that the gap, if you will, the difference by race and ethnicity is closing over time. The other obvious conclusion is that a gap still exists, even in 2004. Now, if you turn the chart over, you see 10th grade reading, the same information. And you'll notice at the 10th grade level, a different pattern, a general flattening of scores over time, over that same time period, and the gap, if you will, or the difference in numbers on the basis of race and ethnicity continues to appear, and in some cases even increases. So, what is the achievement gap? In general, as these two slides show, it is a persistent level of underachievement by students of color, students in poverty, and students for whom English is their second language. And it tends to be more pronounced at the high school level than at the elementary level. So what are we doing about this? The goal of closing the achievement gap is woven throughout the department's policies and its projects. Closing the gap will take concerted effort over time. We need to focus on basically three things. First, we have to fix the system itself. We have to also identify effective programs and strategies, and then we have to bring more partners into the work, and I'd like to talk about those three elements briefly. First, the systemic changes. What can we do with the system of educational delivery to address this issue? We have talked before about fully integrating the data system in a way that links not only elementary, middle, and secondary schools throughout the state, across the district, but also connects to institutions of higher education, as well as to provide better information and more accountability for academic improvement over time. Can we monitor the progress of students effectively over time? Now, to increase accountability, we're working with community colleges and higher education to use a student number or an identifier that would track the student not only through kindergarten through 12th grade, but also into the system of higher education. What this will do is let us answer really basic questions that are students adequately prepared for higher education in the state of Oregon. And we're, of course, asking that question not just in the average, but in all of this, all of the groups that are served by the system. We're also talking about aligning and realigning, restructuring the accountability structure. We're redoing the way districts submit plans and spending allocations to us to integrate that in a more seamless system, reducing paperwork but also clarifying focus. We have developed new technologies to look at how districts spend state school fund and how that compares to the results that on student performance that they're able to generate. We have begun the process of integrating both the state and the federal accountability system into a single, more coherent and more useful accountability system. And districts are being held to a higher level of accountability for their plans for improvement and specifically looking on their ability to close the achievement gap. And the district will more, the department rather, will more closely review district improvement plans in this area. We want to involve the local education service district more in the building of local capacity around closing the achievement gap. And we're holding districts more accountable for results in their plans. Specifically, you may have seen in the press, under No Child Left Behind, we now have identified 15 districts in the state that are in what the federal law calls district improvement status. These are districts that have been identified for not making adequate progress over a two consecutive year period of time, and we're working more directly with them. And finally, we're developing better technical capacity to identify schools that are successfully closing the gap. We refer to that as finding schools of excellence in the state. Secondly, what are some of the programmatic changes that can be made? Those are structural and systemic changes. I'll talk a little bit about some of the programmatic changes. First, and one of the most exciting, is our literacy initiative. We are spending $67 million a year in the Reading First program. We have established the statewide literacy leadership statewide steering committee. I'd like to publicly recognize the contribution of Senator Starr serving as a member of that committee. We're implementing a Lexile system. The Lexile system comes out on our reports to parents that helps the parent identify the reading level of their child, and they can use that information to identify books and materials that they're at the appropriate reading level for their children. We've also developed a high school initiative using a major grant from the Wallace Foundation, and we have identified six demonstration sites, high school sites, that are working on incorporating secondary literacy or high school level literacy. In your packet is a list of those six sites. We've dramatically increased some of the work that we're doing with English language learners. The department has created assessment tools in both Spanish and Russian so that we can effectively assess academic performance. For example, if I presented a student mathematics problems that were written in English, but Russian was the student's first language, the question is, have I assessed the student's ability to read English, or have I assessed the student's ability to do mathematics? And in this case, we are interested in their mathematics knowledge. We are also working on the identification of reading assessments in Spanish. Now, this is a brand new area, not only for Oregon, but throughout the United States, particularly for students who are new to the United States, for whom Spanish was their first language, but they obviously the process of learning to read, to recognize characterization, to read for comprehension, to interpret information, is a process that cuts across different languages. So for when a student first comes to the United States, being able to assess that student's ability to read in a native language is something that we are working on. As part of No Child Left Behind, we have developed a new set of English language proficiencies, and I need to make a distinction here between the state standards in English language arts and the English language proficiencies. These are developed specifically for students for whom English is not their native language, and it lays out in grade level pattern the indicators of the acquisition of English. Currently, school districts are required to assess all of their native or their English language learner students on a district assessment of those proficiencies. That is changing. We are currently in the process of developing a common statewide English language proficiency assessment tool. We hope to pilot that soon, and within the next 2 years it would be operational throughout the state. That will give us a tremendous amount of information on a common data framework for all of our students. We've also this year begun collecting information on what programs are students for whom English is a second language, what kinds of programs are they assigned to, and we'll be able to look at the effectiveness of those programs over time. We have an excellent partnership with the government of Mexico, known as the Oregon-Mexican Education Partnership Program. We made available to us through the government of Mexico our materials and assessment tools, websites, and a whole variety of material in Spanish. And we have worked with our education service district, specifically Willamette ESD here in Salem, to create 18 community plazas throughout the state where planning for these materials has taken place and parents and students gain access to the materials. In Native American issues, we've been working very closely with the Confederated Tribes in Oregon. We have just recently revised the Oregon Indian Education Plan. We meet regularly with government to government. And there is a second group that I personally meet with on a regular basis, which is a group of Indian education educators who are working on the preservation and teaching of Oregon indigenous languages in our schools. And finally, we are engaged in public recognition for schools that are showing progress. We have conducted the first Closing the Achievement Gap conference last year, in which we identified Oregon schools of excellence and invited them to present to other schools. The next conference is scheduled for April, the Closing the Gap conference 2. We're improving our strategies to be able to accurately identify schools that are effectively closing the gap. And finally, the third area, Madam Chair, is the development of partnerships. We cannot do this work alone. The department has created the Underrepresented and Minority Student Achievement Advisory Team. This is a quarterly meeting of leaders throughout the state from a variety of organizations and community advocate groups to talk about closing the achievement gap and to help us better study our own strategies and to advise the superintendent and our staff on steps that we can take. I must highlight the university community. The university community, and you're going to hear more about that today, has done a great deal of work in incorporating these ideas both in teacher and administrator preparation programs. Teacher standards and practices, and it's my understanding you will be hearing from the executive director next week, has also done an exceptional job of taking recommendations about cultural competence and recently revising the standards for administrative licensure in the state and incorporating cultural competence into all seven of the new standards. You'll hear more about that. And finally, we meet regularly with both professional organizations and community advocacy organizations to talk about these items that I have been discussing. And Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I could move into a brief discussion of cultural competence. It's somewhat related to this, or I can stop here briefly. What is your question?
I think you can just keep moving along. You've answered two of the questions on my list already, so okay. You're doing pretty well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are some excellent people that want to be in front of you today, so I will try to hurry.
Okay, thank you.
We talk briefly about cultural competence. I probably shouldn't need to say much of anything after looking at the data that Richard provided you prior to my coming up here. It really highlights the issue. I would refer you in your packet to information drawn from the state report card on student demographics. At the top it says minority student information. What those data show are clear trends in enrollment diversity and projected increases. You will see in the first chart, for example, on the first page, that minority student enrollment has steadily increased from 1992 to the present, and especially Latino student enrollment, which has increased 171% during that period of time. Additional charts show the dramatic increase in the diversity of Oregon students, but let me specifically reference the chart that's marked page 49 in that handout. And in that chart, you will see that the diversity of students is not found in the Oregon teaching force. If you look at the far right-hand column, you'll notice that 23% of Oregon students are identified as minority group members, while only 4.7% of the teaching workforce are identified as minority members. So in that picture, there are three key areas of cultural competence that we identify. First is creating an environment in our schools and districts in which all students and families feel welcome, respected, and valued for who they are. Second, we need to prepare teachers and administrators to work effectively in a multicultural environment and classroom. And third, we need to better diversify our workforce. The Oregon Revised Statute addresses these areas in several places. I have provided a copy and it, in your packet. It's a brown-covered booklet. These are the proceedings of the first multicultural summit that was held in May of 2004. In the back of that booklet, there's a summary of the relevant statutes. But in summary, these statutes require the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon Department of Higher Education to increase efforts in providing multicultural curriculum, to collaborate to increase minority student access to higher education and to schools of education, to collaborate in the recruitment, admission, retention and graduation of minority teachers, and to provide tuition incentives and mentoring to beginning teachers and administrators. And I'd like to point out, and we will be dealing with this issue for the Ways and Means Subcommittee, the latter two items, the tuition incentives and the funding for the mentorship program, was withdrawn by the legislature, and those two parts of Oregon law are currently unfunded. During the 2003 session, the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education attached a budget note to the Department of Education's budget to address cultural competency in the collaboration with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and the Oregon University System to define proficiencies for teachers and administrators for demonstrating cultural competence, to incorporate training into teacher pre-service programs, and to establish other training initiatives. The budget note further directs the agency to collaborate with other partners on recruiting a more diverse workforce and to review the incentive program to attract new teachers to high-need schools in Oregon. We've been very active in these areas, and I believe significant progress has been made. First of all, we had to make this an agency priority. We did that by establishing an internal group, we call it the Cultural Competence Charter Group, to first study internally what we are doing as an agency. We've looked at staff recruitment for our own agency. Our Human Resources Department has very aggressively pursued that. We worked on staff training for the entire agency staff and to coordinate across the agency our efforts in this area. Second, we had to create a definition. What do we mean by cultural competence? The leaders from around the state came together at Lewis and Clark in May of 2004 for the state's first Cultural Competence Summit. I've provided you a copy of the proceedings. You will find the working definition of cultural competency agreed upon during that process on page 3. This definition focuses both on individuals and on organizations, that they would have values and behaviors that enable them to work effectively in a cross-cultural manner, that individuals and organizations would value diversity, and that these values would be present and visible in all aspects of leadership, policy making, and service delivery. So as we came together around that definition, you'll also see in that report how each segment of this process identified for itself next steps in moving this agenda forward. So what are we doing about this? The state has secured a major grant from the Wallace Foundation. We are part of a collaboration of other states called the State Action for Educational Leadership Program, sometimes referred to as SAELP, S-A-E-L-P. The first phase was to study leadership from the point of view of administrative license. That work has been completed. You will hear more from Vicki Chamberlain about that. The second piece of work was a $600,000 grant for demonstration sites. I've given you information on where those sites are. Most recently, and I should point out in your packet, there is a handout that I won't review with you in detail, but it lists the most recent actions of this statewide initiative on cultural competence. But very briefly, we are working with the Oregon Association of Latino Administrators and sponsoring a conference on the 12th of February, coming up very shortly. We recently held a town hall forum and a taping session for a national radio program called Justice Talking at Portland State University. This was a day-long conference where all elements of the university community came together to talk about how cultural competence was being incorporated in both their recruitment and licensing programs. We've created a network of demonstration districts. We've secured a supplemental grant specifically for Portland Public Schools along with the City of Boston and the City of Chicago to develop leadership in this area. We are continuing to provide and fund research on the impact of this work, and we have established a statewide website on cultural competence, which you can get to from our website. We continue to work with advocacy groups, particularly Native American groups and Latino organizations, as I've described earlier. We're working with the university community to strengthen preparation programs, and I would like to highlight the work of the Oregon Association of Colleges of Teachers of Teacher Education, OACTE, which has just in the last 2 days published its summary of next steps that it intends to take in response to the Cultural Competence Summit held in November at Portland State. We are working on additional information for you about the reopening of the funding for incentives for both college tuition and tuition reimbursement programs that are listed in the statute, and we continue to expand the work with the government of Mexico. Finally, what are our challenges? There are several, and I will be brief. First, we need to improve the level of community engagement in this work. This is fundamental. We've heard this from every one of our advocacy groups. Secondly, we need to better prepare schools to address the needs. We need better translation services. We need materials in multiple languages. And most importantly, we need to continue our professional development needs. And specifically to professional development, I'd like to turn to my colleague, Charlie Benitez, from the Department of Education, who has been doing both personally and working with colleagues around our efforts in training and professional development throughout the state, and we have some information we'd like to share with you.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. Just your name for the record, Mr. Benitez.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Charlie Benitez. I'm an educational specialist with the Oregon Department of Education. And what I'll share with you, and I passed out to Don a one-page bulleted item of activities and things that we do with the field around cultural competency and multicultural education. Let me first say that in listening to Pat and thinking about, as he was talking about this, the systemic, the programmatic, and the partnerships that he was explaining to the committee, there's a process also that trickles down to what we do at the specialist level and how we implement some of those things on a more basic with schools individually, with groups of teachers and schools as well. So I'll try to explain that piece clearly. There's four conferences that we participate. There's many conferences that we participate in. But four that I'm going to share with you is that that we provide multicultural education workshops, cultural competency trainings. The trainings may involve implementation and evaluation of cultural competency for educators. One venue is the Violence Prevention Summer Institute that happens in July at Oregon State University, and that's an opportunity for all educators to attend that. It's in the summertime, but it's a partnership as well with the Oregon Juvenile Justice System, OYA, Oregon Youth Authority, and other partners and other state agencies. There's also a conference that happens twice a year, the Oregon Association of Compensatory Education, which happens in the fall and actually starts tomorrow in Seaside. And that conference is basically focused around federal programs. A lot of the federal programs information is shared with educators at that conference, and there's also opportunities for cultural competency training, information, and multicultural education as well. Another big conference that we had just started last year was the Achievement Gap Conference, which brought a lot of stakeholders and different partners together in looking at the achievement gap, and not only looking at the achievement gap, but what are some ways that we can participate in looking at methodology to implement throughout the curriculum and trying to close that achievement gap. And lastly, I'll just share one last one. Let me see on my list here. The governor's conference that he has that goes through Oregon Youth Authority. It's the overrepresentation of minority youth in the juvenile justice system. And that's a very large conference as well. Again, that's the partnership piece that Pat was talking about. But ODE is very involved in that piece as far as presenting, again, multicultural education opportunities for educators and for others that work within the juvenile justice system that are educators that teach juveniles who are incarcerated. Other types of training have been through the Healthy Kids Learn Better Coalition, which is a large it's a partnership again with Oregon Health Division and with DHS and the Oregon Department of Education, and providing providing information and technical assistance around working with immigrant families and working and providing a culturally competent way of doing that. We have provided also workshops for teacher educators at Portland State University and at Pacific University around multicultural education. Let me see. We have created a directory, a multicultural education resource directory, which was a result of some of the work from Senate Bill 103 that we have developed and put on our webpage and is a resource for other educators. And lastly, I'll just share a little bit about my work is with the area of Title I-C, federal programs, migrant education, and we're very involved in a binational teacher exchange program where teachers come from Mexico to work in the summertime with our teachers here in the United States, and that creates an opportunity for not only opportunity for the teachers in itself, but for opportunity for teachers here in the United States to learn a little more around cultural competency and what it is to infuse a multicultural perspective into the curriculum.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed with what the department's doing and your ability to answer my questions without knowing what they are. I did have one, though, that wasn't answered, and I'm concerned about the children who are not immigrants. They are of immigrant descent, but they were born and raised here. What are we doing to keep them in school? Because I think they suffer from some of the same problems that our immigrant children do.
Correct. Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. And there is a distinction, not only programmatically, but in how funds are distributed between students who are identified as migrant status or students for whom English is not their first language. Those are two different groups. They are funded differently. For example, the Title I-C migrant education funds that Mr. Benitez was just talking about are specifically targeted at students who are identified as migrant, and there's a set of qualifications for that identification. Students who are identified as limited English proficient can be native born. For example, it is possible to identify even a Native American student in Oregon for English language learner status, or students who are identified as coming from a household where English, a language other than English, is spoken. In the packet that I provided you, there is a table that shows that that in Oregon, this information is collected on something called a home language identification survey that is required of students who may need LEP services. We've identified 138 languages that are reported as being spoken in households in Oregon. 72% of that number is Spanish, followed by Russian as the second category. But then if you look at the chart, there is a huge array of languages spoken in our schools. And those students are not necessarily migrant status, but they are identified as limited English proficient. And they receive a half weight in the funding formula, as you know, under Oregon State regulation. So they receive additional funding for services that way.
Okay. And then I had another question. How is the... you're having staff service training for your teachers and your staff and the department, so they are culturally competent. That's what I gathered from your testimony.
Sure.
What has the department done to recruit and retain and promote its own diverse workforce? And I asked this question of Mr. Hernandez on Monday from the State Board, and he said that the department wasn't doing very good at that. So I'll hear your answer.
Madam Chair, I was here with Mr. Hernandez's response, and I would say that I would agree with him to an extent. First of all, our staff has not been growing. We have experienced staff reduction and decline, so we've not had a lot of space to add members to our workforce. We are, however, working not only internally but with other agencies in the state in the state's affirmative action initiative. We have aggressively publicized any vacancies we do have, and we are trying as best we can to recruit a more diverse workforce. I would certainly agree with Mr. Hernandez that we have a lot of room to grow in that area. We have also tried to look at the level of preparation of all of our existing workforce. To give you an example, we have provided training in Native American issues to every member of the Oregon Department of Education, and we are now going through that for a second time. So even with our existing workforce, it is not as diverse as we would like. We are trying to recruit a more diverse workforce, but we are also trying to make sure that our existing force is well trained in these issues.
Thank you. And I have one final question, then I'll open it up to my other committee members, and then we need to move along. One of the things I want to ensure is that when you gather this data about student ethnicity, gender, and primary language, that when you collect that, that it's confidential and it's maintained and integrated into the data system. So can you assure this committee that that's being done?
Madam Chair, not only can I assure you that, I can assure you that this is a tough issue and one that we spend a lot of time on. The Family Education Records Privacy Act, or FERPA, is a federal set of regulations that control this work. I can tell you that in some of the data integration work that I described earlier, we have had to seek clarity from the U.S. Department of Education on FERPA regulations and our ability even to transfer student achievement information. Under No Child Left Behind, it required ultimately an agreement between the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Education on the ability for districts and the state to use free and reduced price lunch eligibility as an indicator of poverty. That also, the reason being that free and reduced price lunch information actually belongs to the Department of Agriculture, not to the Department of Education, and it literally required a cabinet-level decision with work from the president to get us to be able to share that information. It's a very important issue, and we're trying to be as respectful as we can about privacy rights and also try to take advantage of some of these technologies to improve the data for decision-making. But in all cases, we comply with FERPA regulations.
Thank you very much. Do any of you have questions? Great. Well, gentlemen, I thank you for coming today. I'm sure you'll be back. It's a pleasure meeting you today, Mr. Benitez.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing you again, Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will now bring up our next group of folks, and we will stay here past 5 o'clock so that you can have a presentation. I'm going to try to get this committee out at 5 o'clock, but we've had such a wealth of wonderful information today, I just don't want to cut it short. Dr. Yvette Weber-Davis and Joyce Harris, if you can come forward and share your wonderful information with us, we'd appreciate it. And just state your name for the record, and we can get started. Thank you. I always come home with more paper than I came in with.
Good. good afternoon, good evening, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I'm Yvette Weber-Davis from the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office. I am Director of Diversity Planning and Special Projects and also the Systems Liaison with Education Preparation Programs. It is a pleasure to be here before you. And I'd like to provide some information on our recent activities regarding cultural competence in the preparation of school personnel. The packet that you just received gives an overview of several initiatives in which we have recently engaged. The first of which, also that Dr. Burke alluded to, was our November 30th, 2004, Higher Education Cultural Competence Summit. This was an event, and I put emphasis on the word event. It's not all the work that we're doing. It's one day. But I think it was very informative and a very good beginning for additional work that we will be doing in higher education. On November 30th, we gathered approximately 140 faculty and administrators from colleges and schools of education throughout Oregon's public and private institutions. Mm-hmm. So 18 institutions were represented that have some type of educator or administrator preparation programs. This was held at Portland State University with funding by the New York Times, and we had an opportunity that day to begin at 8 in the morning and go until about 8:30 that evening.
Oh,
focused on well, we have the stamina, we're up to it. But focused on issues related to cultural competence and also achievement gap issues for students. What you have in your packet is, first of all, an overview of the agenda from that day, the second page, which illustrates the wealth of information and expertise that was shared. One of the most exciting initiatives of the day was that several of our institutions came together and presented poster sessions. These were dedicated to their current efforts in terms of coursework, field experiences, research, publications, etc., that speak to issues of enhanced cultural competence. You can see that we really had a broad representation, including public and private school participation. Also that morning, we had a panel discussion of leaders from around the state, including Joyce Harris, who provided insights about those existing initiatives, and we really took the opportunity during that time to discuss what could enhance the work that we're doing. I should say also that this initiative for the full day could not have come off without the dedicated work of the Oregon Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, OACTE, and the individuals within that group who provided their expertise to helping pull this together. We followed the morning activities with an afternoon devoted to looking ahead toward future concerns. And during that time, we had an opportunity to think about additional activities in which we may want to engage, and also an opportunity for the faculty and administrators to have small breakout sessions in which they discussed pertinent topics relating to where do we go from here. We talked about assessment and accountability, how we know that what we're doing has an impact, and understanding the fact that right now we know some information, but there is a need for additional information so that what we're doing will be very focused on the outcomes wanted. And I'll come back to that one in just a few minutes. We had an opportunity to talk about curriculum and how we can infuse cultural competence into the curriculum in our colleges and schools of education. We talked about faculty development opportunities because, as I'm sure you know, this does not happen in a vacuum. And in fact, when we talk about cultural competence, we're talking about lifelong learning opportunities. And so even for our faculty members, additional opportunities to enhance what they already know. We took the opportunity to discuss recruitment and retention activities. And these were really focused on enhancing the diversity of our college faculties that are teaching these future educators. And we discussed university and community connections and school partnerships. We ended the day at 4 o'clock with a discussion of preliminary policy implications and next steps. And this was our opportunity to really look at, of all the things that are out there and being done, where do we need to go from here? I'd say that a lot of very good information came out of those sessions, but essentially, what I'd say is the principal outcome is the need for enhanced partnership efforts. And as we're working with the Oregon Department of Education, with districts, with local and regional entities, we really have enhanced opportunities to do more in terms of producing culturally competent educators. The evening on the 30th then focused on a town hall forum. And this was, though Dr. Burke was very modest, actually he has gone national. He now has a national reputation. And he had the opportunity for a debate on issues of educational achievement with Chester Finn from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. The taping of the show, I think, really was a capstone event for the day, in that it really brought an opportunity for people to better understand and to engage in dialogue and ask questions about not only the achievement gap issues, but how we can most effectively have an impact in terms of preparing educators and in terms of practice within the classrooms. And also in the evening, we had a town hall meeting. Senator Gortley, Superintendent Castillo, Dean Phyllis Edmondson from Portland State University, and Mr. George Russell from the Eugene 4J Public School District actually engaged in a panel discussion about teaching diverse student populations in Oregon, the challenges and successes associated with that, and also what needs to be done in the future. So that full day of more than 12 hours of activities really, I thought, was very engaging, and it really provided us a very good opportunity to look at these issues from a number of perspectives. Beginning on page 3 of your packet, actually pages 3 through 9, you'll find poster session descriptions, and these are from the poster sessions that I mentioned that were set up in the morning and available throughout the day. This gives a very good overview of many of the initiatives in which Oregon public and private institutions are currently engaged in terms of educator preparation initiatives toward cultural competence. I won't go over those, but I will say that if you have an opportunity to peruse them, you will really see a broad wealth and depth of approaches that I think are very heartening. I wanted to really spend a little bit of time talking about our next steps, because as I mentioned at the beginning, November 30th was an event. We have, since November 30th, taken the opportunity to begin planning our next steps. Last week, Interim Chancellor Pernsteiner and I met with members of the Oregon Association of Colleges of Teacher Education to discuss for several hours where do we go from here. Those members were all present at the November 30th event and really had an opportunity to discuss how productive it was to, first of all, share and learn from each other. That's something that, even though we're in the same state, we rarely have an opportunity to do, particularly around one dedicated issue such as cultural competence. And as you can imagine, and as I'm sure you know, our colleges and schools of education have a wealth of other activities and issues that they must deal with as well. So, really, people found great value in this type of gathering, but wanted to move ahead, and we have been charged with three areas that we will be working toward. First of all, will be enhanced assessment measures. Really making sure that we have some measure of progress toward producing culturally competent educators. We've already had, through the wealth of faculty expertise that's available in Oregon, a self-assessment produced, and I know that a number of our institutions will be utilizing that self-assessment as a pilot. In addition to that, we will be working with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and other partners to really determine what is the best way to infuse and also assess what is happening with cultural competence. Our second charge related to enhanced research initiatives. This is also very closely related to the assessment issue, but really focused on what is the impact of what we do, how do we know that what we're doing is relevant and appropriate. And again, this is an opportunity to draw upon the wealth of faculty expertise that is available to determine empirical evidence for the approaches that we're taking. And finally, our third charge relates to enhanced partnership efforts. And I mentioned earlier, and others have mentioned, this is not work that any one educational sector can do alone. We realize that even though we're preparing a number of new educators coming into Oregon's system, we're not preparing all of them. We understand that leadership and efforts are necessary at both the district and building levels once educators are in the workforce, and also, most importantly, I think, that this these efforts have to be expansive and extensive. You don't learn everything there is to know about cultural competence in a class or in a month or a year. This really is an ongoing learning experience. And so we're looking for opportunities to enhance those efforts. The OACTE group, in turn, has established a task force or a work group to really delve into how we will take those three charges and put them into practice. I will be working with them, and we will be convening within the next few weeks and really trying to establish action plans that take into account all of our public and private institutions for the next couple of years at least, and really moving this agenda forward. So those were the highlights that I wanted to share with you. I'd like to close by saying that really these efforts are appropriate. They're very timely, given not only the demographics, but also the differences that we see in the data you received earlier in terms of who's being prepared and going into our classrooms and who our students are. There is that big difference in terms of students not always having teachers who can relate to them on the same cultural level. And so given that we are very committed to this work, it really comes down to leadership And I think what is very heartening to me is that a number of people from all sectors are stepping up to that mantle of leadership and really taking ownership for moving this agenda forward. Thank you. I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. I think we'll hear from Ms. Harris, and then if we have some questions, we'll go from there. I appreciate your presentation. It was awesome.
My name is Joyce Harris. I am the director of the Equity Center located at Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory in Portland, Oregon. And what I bring to this discussion is that I work with teachers out in the field, helping them to acquire the skills, mm-hmm. the pedagogies that they need to be successful in working with all populations of students. But specifically, my program is funded to work with teachers so that they can provide equitable learning and teaching environments for students regardless of their race, their gender, or their national origin. So we get into a lot of cultural issues. We are funded by the U.S. Department of Education, and so we are regional training and technical assistance centers, and we work in Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa, Palau, and Saipan. So we have a lot of different ways of looking at culture as we work with teachers in different cultural environments. What I have provided you with is a literature review that one of our staff members at Northwest Lab put together at the request of the Oregon Department of Education. It's research-based resources, cultural competency of schools and teachers in relation to student success. And I think that's what we're really needing to discuss. What is the impact, or what impact do we want to see as an outcome of teachers becoming culturally competent and using culturally responsive pedagogy in their classrooms? What we would like to see is that it allows all children to use the capital that they bring into the classroom in order to be academically successful. And now people are really scurrying around to try to put these research studies together. I would be dishonest if I'd say there's a wealth of research out there that really speaks to how the use of culture closes the achievement gap, but it is there. There is research out there. One of the training models that we use with, we've done quite a few trainings throughout this region, is on sheltered instruction. And it is based on 8 research-based principles that have to do with helping teachers, particularly those teachers who are mainstream, who have English language learners in their classroom. And what are some of the research-based strategies that will allow them to not only engage these students in the classroom, but to also teach them content, teach them language proficiency? And the connection I could make, going back to what Pat Burke mentioned about the English language proficiency standards that the state of Oregon and all the states are required by NCLB to develop, is while you're teaching children to be proficient in English, which is their second language, you also want to make sure that you don't neglect their academic progress. And so when we work with teachers around issues of working with English language learners, we make sure that we keep them focused on, there are 2 things that you need to be accomplishing. You need to be developing their proficiency in reading, writing, speaking, and listening the English language, but you also need to make sure that they are keeping up with the academic content. That's cultural competency, because some of the strategies that you use, for example, are building on their prior knowledge. So if you have students who come from other cultural environments, as a teacher, you have the proficiencies to allow you to use that as a bridge in the classroom, to engage students, to get them excited, to get them involved. One of the trainings that we do is to help teachers to understand what are the stages that students go through when they're acquiring language, and what are they experiencing. How many of you have been to another country where you didn't speak the language? How did you feel when you walked into a setting when everyone was speaking a language and you couldn't? Mm-hmm. How did you feel, Senator Starr?
Well, I felt out of place.
Yeah. A little uncomfortable?
A little uncomfortable, and was pretty interesting. I've been in several countries where they spoke a different language. The amazing thing to me is, as I attempted to learn some basics,
exactly,
I found the natives were very quick to mm-hmm. find me a translator. I've got an English speaker here that will help you.
Well, what we help teachers to understand is if you're a student and you come into an environment where everyone is speaking English and you can't speak English, something happens to you physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
There's a period we call the silent period, where children just don't say anything. And then there's another concept called, we talk about the affective filter. If I were to start addressing you in another language that you didn't understand, your affective filter would go up and be like, oh my God, what is she saying? I don't know. And especially if you thought that at the end of my presentation I was going to give you a test. So this is all a part of cultural competency, making sure that we use everything that we have available to us and the knowledge that we have about the role of culture as a bridge. You know, we always talk about cultural bridges, cultural references. And so this piece here, the literature review, has some findings from some of the studies that have looked at programs that have used cultural competency. And there are a couple of them that I wanted to just point out to you. On page 15, we look at what teachers understand and how they use verbal and nonverbal communication styles of other cultures in the classroom. You know, we talk about learning styles. We talk about how different individuals learn differently. What we like to do when we train teachers is help them to even look at their own style of learning. And that becomes powerful when they realize that I don't learn by somebody standing in front of me just like a talking head. You know, I need hands-on. I need you to show me how to do this. I need you to sit with me and guide me through this. And then you help them understand, you know, maybe it's your students need this too. And then you bring culture into it. And that opens up the door for you to bring parents and community. And so the whole notion of cultural competency really rests on us seeing culture and strategies that are built on cultural knowledge as a way to effectively engage students in the teaching and learning environment. And I would go so far as to say, for me being someone who works with teachers, I have seen it work with teachers. One of the areas that we like to look at is having teachers sit down and think about who are they as cultural beings. Because sometimes we don't even think about that. You know, I'm cultural, you're cultural. And we move on so many fast tracks, we forget to use what we bring as cultural beings into an environment to enhance that environment, to strengthen that environment. So culture and cultural pedagogy and cultural competence really brings us to one basic central point, is how can we use what we know about culture, what can we know about the culture of the groups that we interact with as a way to enhance the work that we do. And when it comes to children, I think there have been enough studies, there's been enough research that shows that children who feel disengaged can often have their battery turned on again if you use something that's built on their prior knowledge, built on their cultural experiences, built on their communities. And that's what cultural competency really gets down to. How do we prepare our teachers to effectively use research-based practices in the classroom so that we have children who are able to academically succeed because that culture has done something to make them want to engage, to want to learn.
Wow.
I'm almost brought to tears here. Seriously, the presentation we've had today from beginning to end has been just phenomenal. And, you know, the demographic study was very enlightening for me. I had no idea of our changing demographics. And, you know, I sit here and think, I've never been in a situation where I've been in a country where I couldn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. But I did move around a lot as a child, and I went to a lot of different schools. And in some sense, I felt that because when you go to a new school, you have the silent period, and you have the effective filter because everyone else seems to know everybody else, and you don't know how to act or what to do or what clique to join in. Even when you're little, you don't understand that. So I felt that as a child. That's why I always joked around in class and had bad citizenship grades because I wanted attention. But I was a smart kid. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it took good teachers to bring me and engage me in the classroom and, you know, let me know there was a place here. Even though home life was really, really bad, there was a place here in the classroom. And to do that for a child of a different culture is just tremendous. And I really applaud both of you for your involvement, and I'm impressed that the Department of Education asked you for this information. So that tells me they're doing
work. If I could just add, the next step for Northwest Lab with this research literature review is we're actually putting out a publication. We do a series called By Request, and we're anticipating by late spring maybe we're going to have a publication called Cultural Competence. We're still going back and forth on what the title will ultimately be. But it's going to be phenomenal because we're going to showcase actual teachers in this region.
Oh, wow.
We have some in this state who have embrace cultural competency and are using it, and so the stories are going to be phenomenal. It's going to be an excellent piece of work.
Thank you. Senator Scar, did you have a question?
Not a question. I wanted to make a couple of comments.
Fire off.
As we become more diverse in our population, I really hope that we don't lose sight of the fact that we have an American culture.
Oh, absolutely.
And that we continue to integrate the populations that are coming to us into an American culture. I think that historically we've been pretty successful as a nation in doing that. But we've never had the infusion of the wide variety that has happened in the last quarter century. The other thing, I guess I have a different experience with cultural competency because I have a missionary son in Cameroon, Africa, who's dealing with tribal peoples who speak Moloko. National language is French, and he's trying to deliver to them a written local language so that they can actually learn to read in their own language. He has succeeded in developing a primer, and he's taught 30 teachers how to teach the children to read their own language. I have a granddaughter in Mexico, 8 years there now, 18 years old this month, teaching English as a second language. Very competent teacher because she's become very fluent in the language. In fact, tells me, living with us for 3 months this summer, she thinks in Spanish now.
Yeah.
And We live in a very much smaller world today. When I started at the Capitol this morning, my wife punched just one punch of the cell phone. And almost instantly, she was talking to her son in Cameroon, Africa, on a cell phone.
Wow, that's great.
This is technology that was undreamed of 25 years ago. So it's wonderful, the reports we've had today and the progress we're making. Keep up the good work. Charge ahead.
Well,
don't hold back.
Well, I just wanted to say that American culture is really everything that we have had as a, and we've only had problems as a nation when we've rejected other cultures.
Absolutely.
And so I think that what we're saying about cultural competency and cultural diversity is that in that diversity there is much richness, many resources, many opportunities to teach and learn. And I think that's what will make us and will continue to make us strong as a state and as a nation when we recognize, you know, that diversity and the strength that we all gain from it.
And that's why we
as Americans
leave no one behind.
Absolutely. That's a great end.
That is a very good end. Thank you, ladies. Thank you so much for coming and being part of this very special day for our committee.
Thanks for inviting us.
And capping off the wonderful week. So I hope to see you again. And this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.